Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of the Cure Panel, joining you from India. This is Cure Panel's 71st episode and our Breast Cancer Talk Series. We have featured Dr. Julie Grallo, Dr. Diana Atai, Dr. Jovita Olwari, and Dr. Hope Rogo in our talk series previously. In our last episode, we discussed coping with the toxicity of chemotherapy during breast cancer treatment. Today's topic of discussion is surgical treatments for breast cancer. Most patients with breast cancer have surgery to remove the cancer from the breast. Breast cancer surgeries differ by the amount of healthy tissue that is removed with the tumor. Surgery involves removing the tumor and nearby margins. The margin is the surrounding tissue that might be cancerous. The goal of surgery is to remove not only the tumor, but also enough of the margin to be able to test for the spread of the cancer. Some people with stage 2 or stage 3 cancer may have to receive chemotherapy first, which is known as preoperative or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The goal is to shrink the tumor. By making it smaller first, you may have the option of a breast-conserving surgery or lumpectomy instead of a mastectomy. To learn more about surgical treatments of breast cancer, we have a very eminent doctor with us, Dr. Mary Jemignani. Dr. Jemignani is a surgeon who specializes in the diagnosis and surgical treatment of breast cancer. She is dual-trained as a breast surgeon and as a gynecologic oncologist, having completed fellowships in both disciplines. Her training has allowed her to focus her research endeavors on hereditary familial cancers, concentrating on breast cancers caused by mutations in the BRCA genes. Dr. Jemignani has had extensive experience in the diagnosis and treatment of hereditary breast cancer, including surgery for prevention by risk-reducing bilateral mastectomy. Additionally, she is a fellowship director for the Breast Surgical Fellowship Training Program and responsible for the educational training program for a highly selected group of surgeons choosing to specialize in breast cancer in breast surgery at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jemignani.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
My co-host for the day is breast cancer survivor Beverly McKee. Beverly is an author, blogger, and inspirational speaker. She combines her clinical skills and personal experience with breast cancer to deliver a message of hope, support, and inspiration to her worldwide following through social media and speaking engagements. Welcome, Beverly.
Thank you, Priya. I'm excited to be here tonight.
Before I hand over to Beverly, I would like to remind our audience that we will be taking in questions at the end of the discussion. I know many of you have sent in your questions to us. If you come up with more during the course of discussion for our expert or panel, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you live on air to ask your questions. You can also mail me, priya@trilex.com, with your question and we will try to get them answered. With that, I will now hand over to Beverly to begin with our expert session. Beverly, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya. Dr. Jemignani, I'm very excited to talk to you and share all of your insights with our listening audience all over the world today. Can you just give us a really brief background about what you do on a daily basis with your patients, just so we have some insight?
Yes, I'd love to. So I'm now a breast cancer specialist, specializing in seeing and treating women at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center who basically come to us to discuss treatment, a surgical treatment of their breast cancer, but also many times to come to talk about options for prevention for breast cancer. So on a daily basis, I see patients, I counsel them, and I, as a surgeon, take care of their cancer or prophylactic surgery.
Okay. All right. I'm sure that you see a lot of women, many of whom have been told some very difficult news and others who are trying to prevent it. I love that you're specializing in prevention as well, such a new type of way of approaching this type of diagnosis. And
yes,
I noticed when I was looking through all of your information, and I'm kind of just excited to hear a little bit more about this, I wanted to ask you about your research into special estrogen PET imaging. When I think of a PET scan, I think of, and I've had one before after I was done with treatment, they inject a sugar solution into your veins, and then they look for cancer throughout your body. Can you tell me about this special estrogen PET scan imaging substance?
So this is a special, it's a research tool. It is currently not available outside of research settings. It works very much like a conventional PET scan, but instead of using the sugar substance, we use an estrogen kind of ligand. So a ligand is a substance that binds to the estrogen receptor. Even though it's not estrogen, it acts like that. And so with this special PET study, we're able to inject a special tracer. And in estrogen receptor cancers, it highlights the tumor in the breast and also in other places in the body. And so we found that it was very feasible to do it around the time of surgery, that it was also predictive of what the tumor would be as far as estrogen content in the breast. And in the future, there's a lot of ongoing research into whether it can be used as a tool to gauge response to drugs that are given. So, for example, someone would potentially have this type of PET scan and then take a medication that would block estrogens like tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, those type of medications, and particularly in patients who have disease that has come outside of the breast area and other organs, we can gauge the response by repeating the PET scan a few months later. So very, very innovative and very new and something to definitely keep your eye on for the future.
It's very exciting because I know that a lot of us have the estrogen dependent. I think most of us have that, so it's exciting. Any idea how far in the future that we'll see that in use in just the general setting?
I think that there are quite, we're one of the centers that is using it, and a couple of other centers are looking at whether it can be accepted and FDA approved. So I would say not too far out in the distance.
That's very exciting. We'll keep our eye on that. One of the other things I noticed that you're researching are surgical decisions for lymph node dissection. And is that different?
So this is definitely an interest of mine because I think that as we move forward with surgical treatments, it's important to be able to tailor what we can use and what we do as surgeons to get the information that we need, but also to avoid the morbidity for some of the women that need to have these types of procedures. So an interest of mine has always been to try to get the information with less surgery, so to speak. And so there has been a trial that was a national trial which looked at the use of just sentinel node biopsy alone in women who were having breast conservation surgery, and even if some of the lymph nodes had some tumor cells in it, then it was found in this study not to be necessary to have all of the lymph nodes removed. And so that has made a huge leap forward in how we're able to address surgically the lymph nodes and hopefully decrease the lymphedema rates and all of that associated with these types of procedures that were often done. So my research is looking at two factors that will help us to determine other kinds of subsets of women that could benefit from this too.
That makes a lot of sense. And I know lymphedema is a side effect that a lot of women deal with when they have all of those lymph nodes removed. It's exciting research as well. I have one more question for you, and then we're going to introduce our panelists. I know there's a new study out right now that suggests that a bilateral mastectomy is no more effective in terms of survival rates than a lobectomy. And I'm wondering if you can just kind of share your thoughts about that, especially for somebody who has that BRCA mutation, whether it's a BRCA1 or BRCA2.
Okay, so that study looked at something that, and the data is not necessarily new. So there have been many other published studies that show that having a prophylactic contralateral, so let's say a woman decides to have a mastectomy on the side that's affected, removing the other unaffected breast doesn't necessarily increase the survival, and I agree with that. I think that with the current targeted therapies that we have, when a woman comes in with a diagnosis of a cancer and they're treated for that cancer, many of the therapies that we give that are part of that treatment for the breast cancer do help in prevention for the other side. So if we look at all of the studies that show in an estrogen receptor positive cancer, which is the majority of what women have, you'll need to go on tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors for many years. The contralateral, the other side's risk, is reduced because of medications like that. So ultimately, it doesn't translate to an increase in survival, but it does help in prevention of new cancers. So for women at the highest risk for developing breast cancer, such as our BRCA1 and BRCA2 patients, the contralateral mastectomy, that prophylactic mastectomy, removing the other side, is really an option for reducing risk. So even though it does not ultimately or may not ultimately translate into a better survival, that is because the survival is dependent on the cancer that brought the woman through the door, but it does offer a risk reduction for future cancers.
So that suggests to me that it really is still a very individualized decision-making process between the doctor and the patient.
I totally agree with that, and our discussions are very long, and many times it takes a few visits. It doesn't just happen that you just meet your doctor and say, okay, I'm going to have this done. And particularly in the prophylactic setting where women are making a decision before they have cancer, it's very difficult, and it's certainly a process. So many times I'll sit with a woman and I will have a discussion with them about different options that they may have. I'll have them see one of my plastic surgery colleagues to discuss reconstruction, and maybe they'll speak to one of our social workers about their decision making and things like that. And ultimately, it will be their decision whether they come back and proceed with prophylactic surgery.
All right. Well, thank you for answering my questions. I'm going to turn it back over to Priya. She's going to introduce our panelists for us tonight.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Beverly. On the panel, we have Jennifer McCrea. Jennifer lives in Calgary, Canada. She has a strong family history of ovarian cancer. Jennifer tested positive for BRCA1 in 2005. She was diagnosed with breast cancer at stage 0 in July 2011 when she was 34 years old. Then underwent bilateral mastectomy in August 2011. She has been deemed cancer-free since then, even though the pathology report showed that her cancer was stage 1 and invasive. Jen went on to have a bilateral mastectomy and did not need chemo or radiation. She has since then become a runner, marathoner, and a triathlete. We also have with us Terry Arnold. Terry is founder of the IBC Network Foundation. She was diagnosed with triple-negative inflammatory breast cancer in her right breast in August 2007 and a left triple-negative contralateral tumor soon after. She had 6 months of chemotherapy, a double mastectomy, and daily radiation treatment for 6 weeks, and is now no NED, no evidence of disease. Our third panelist is Lisa Resende. Lisa is Director of Education at FORCE, which is Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of individuals and families affected by hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. Lisa is a BRCA1 mutation carrier. I welcome all the CURE panelists to the CURE Panel Talk Show. Beverly, over to you. You can begin with the panel session.
Great. Thank you to all the panelists for joining us today. And I think everybody has just a little bit different view of what we're talking about, which always makes it for an interesting discussion. Jennifer, welcome. Would you like to ask a question of the doctor for us?
I would. So when you have a patient that comes in that has been recently been given the news that they are a carrier of the BRCA cancer gene mutation, what is it kind of exactly that you give them as your best advice?
Mm-hmm. So Jennifer, that's always very tailored to the person that comes in. And many times our discussions are driven by their questions and their concerns. I particularly focus on their age when they came in, how recently they were told the news that they had a BRCA mutation. Many times women will be at other centers before they actually get to us to have these discussions. We talk about different options. We have at Memorial, we have a special surveillance program where we often screen women with MRIs and mammograms, and I do recommend MRI and mammography to women who have these BRCA genes who are either undecided about having prophylactic mastectomies, have decided that they are not going to have prophylactic mastectomy, or somewhere in the middle. So that is part of our screening strategy to increase our hopefully our detection of these cancers in these very, very high-risk women. So the discussion centers around options. We talk about if someone has a BRCA2 gene, those women are more likely to get estrogen-sensitive types of cancers. So we talk about chemo prevention more with them in the form of tamoxifen if they're premenopausal, or raloxifene, otherwise called Avista, if they're postmenopausal. I also outline what the surgery options are in the decision-making, and I also include a discussion on prophylactic oophorectomy, because I think that is a very, very important component of this hereditary type of cancer. And unlike breast, where we have excellent tools for screening, we do not have very good tools at all for screening for ovarian cancer. So that's part of the discussion, too. And one of the things that's important is that there's recent studies looking at choices that women make when they have these genes. And the majority of women will often go with the first decision, removing the ovaries, pretty soon after they've been tested positive for the gene. And only about a quarter of women decide to do prophylactic mastectomy soon thereafter, or maybe never after they have discovered that they have these BRCA genes. And I think that's part of my discussion, sort of making sure that they understand all of the options, making sure we've outlined what their particular risk is given their age and their family history, and also to help with decision-making about is it right for the person, should they do it, and when should you do it at all. So kind of a process. I don't have a standard algorithm that I follow. It's kind of making sure that we cover all the important things that person wants to know and needs to know.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I'm happy that you do also talk to them about the prophylactic oophorectomy, because that was something that I had after I had breast cancer when I was 35 years old. And so I believe it's a very important thing for women to be considering, maybe even a little bit more so than the breast cancer, just because, like you said, there's not very much way to screen for it and to protect ourselves against it. So I'm glad that you do discuss that with them as well. So
thank you, Jennifer.
Yep.
Thanks for the great question, Jennifer. Terry, you come across to us with a more unique type of breast cancer, a little less common, and I know you've got a question about that.
Well, I do, and I'm very excited that the doctor is getting so many thoughtful answers about this. So I appreciate that very much, and I need to update my bio with you guys because I have lung, and now I have the BRCA gene too. And came at me at quite a shock, being first of all, being triple negative inflammatory breast cancer. Then 5 years later, they said, you know, let's look at your BRCA history. Let's do that test, because I didn't think I'd be a concern for that with no cancer in my family history almost at all and no breast cancer at all. They were quite shocked to find that I actually do have the gene. And out of my 5 children, we've tested our 3 daughters. We haven't done our sons yet. And one of my daughters, my oldest daughter, is 31, is also a carrier. So she's making a lot of these important decisions, the doctors, the surgeon speaking of. But what I would love to have is, in spite of all the great information you give, there is that little subset where we don't really quite fit the standard. And so the surgery choices are different. They're a little bit more aggressive. And a lot of women don't realize, and sometimes I think the doctors don't know due to the rareness of the disease. But nonetheless, it is here. Inflammatory is here. And so do you have some advice to women who have been diagnosed? I meet a lot of women, especially I think since they're young, the surgeons sometimes will say, well, let's not go too aggressively. Let's do a lumpectomy or we'll do same-day reconstruction. And I would like you to address that because I think that is something that's really important, that we have that separation. Oh, by the way, there is something that's a little bit different. Let's get you the custom care you need for what you have.
So Terry, if I could rephrase this, the question that you're asking me. You want me to discuss the biology of the tumor and how that impacts a surgical decision, or just someone comes in with invasive cancer and how do we steer them through the different choices?
Well, let me make it more straightforward. When someone presents with inflammatory, the surgical needs are different than the more standard forms of breast cancer. And a lot of women don't realize that. So I would love to have you as a surgeon address, because 10% of women, or they say maybe as much as 25% of women who have inflammatory may have a lump. They can be very webby and scattered and diffused, like cotton candy is more common. And with it presenting in a stage 3, it's like almost like a whole other animal. And so the surgeon would like to see you address that.
Yeah. So I think, for those folks that are listening, what we're going to discuss or I'm going to go over in the next couple minutes is inflammatory breast cancer tends to be a rare type of breast cancer that's pretty what we term locally advanced. So it's involving a diffuse nature. We don't actually know why women have and get this particular kind of cancer. It is more aggressive. The skin is involved. Surgery per se takes less of a role when you first come in with this diagnosis. And that is an important statement. There are 2 important components of this. One is the doctor that is seeing you, if your breast is red, it's swollen, it's got dimpling that looks like an orange, needs to have like a heightened sense of awareness that this is not normal. So many times we biopsy or we do something that, and many times there is kind of this little bit of delay because it looks like an infection and people aren't sure. But once a diagnosis is made, in these cases, we really do treat with chemotherapy first. It is one of those classic indications to have neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Neoadjuvant meaning before surgery. So even though you may end up in a surgeon's office, that surgeon would most likely and should steer you to medical oncology and chemotherapy if the diagnosis is inflammatory breast cancer at the initial get-go. And so being able to diagnose it and treat it is different than what we're talking about for primary surgery.
Is that very important? Those are very important. Absolutely, very important points to make because with IBC, typically striking younger women, you know, I think sometimes it's like, oh, well, you're young, you're strong, you can beat this, we can get this. And with that webby, diffused nature, you can't get the clean margins, and you can't. You need to have the chemotherapy first. And then we have special needs. The standard of care set out by the National Cancer Institute is the chemotherapy, surgery if appropriate, you know, many weeks of radiation, and then delayed reconstruction. So since you're a surgeon, would you also address what you think would be the appropriate thing for when the surgery time comes? Like you would obviously do a non-skin sparing mastectomy for an IBC patient, would you not?
So one of the beautiful things about targeted therapies and one of the great things that we're seeing more and more is response. So when we give neoadjuvant chemotherapy, we have the ability to see what the breast looks like and what the disease is, and then gauge the response while the tumor is there and see what you have when the chemotherapy is completed. So in these settings, I often do recommend standard mastectomy. We often delay reconstruction because the chemotherapy goes first, surgery goes second, and then after surgery is done, there is 6 weeks of radiation, which tends to be an extended radiation, and then the body needs to heal. So you need to give a good 6 months post this type of approach to then talk about delayed reconstructions. And I think when we're talking about serious conditions like this, I think it's important to explain to the person the rationale for doing this. And also to have the reconstruction later in these particular settings allows the woman to deal with the cancer and be done with it and then go on to the areas that will provide quality of life and all of the other things that we're hoping to achieve.
Well, and I appreciate you breaking this down, and I do realize that this is something that is less common, but because, though, of the serious nature of the disease, it's so wonderful to have someone like you discuss that and explain, oh, by the way, you know, just like you mentioned earlier, the custom treatment that women get or the personalized decisions they make, it's not based just on their emotion. It's based upon their unique need. That's where that customization comes in. And that's one of the things I really love about what I see, the really highly specialized individual therapy that women get. And I have one more question, because I know there's people who want to have your comments, is when a woman, now I know you said 6 months, but I know MD Anderson tends to recommend 2 years, which I know some people think that's longer, but that's the standards that they go by. And they have the world's first clinic devoted to inflammatory. But, you know, they do see, again, the individual decision based upon that person. But what reconstruction options would you be comfortable with as a surgeon? I know some women get expanders, and I see the specialists shy away from that because they feel that since there was skin involvement, that may not be the best choice. What choices would you think would be more appropriate in the case of inflammatory?
Okay, so just to clarify, inflammatory cancers are a very, very, thank goodness, small percentage of what we see. And the majority of women will not have to deal with these decisions, which are very, very difficult. And the treatment tends to be somewhat protracted. So if there has been the decision to delay the reconstruction, which is often what we recommend with inflammatory cancers at the time of mastectomy, and the patient goes through radiation therapy, when the reconstruction needs to be done, it is not possible to put in a tissue expander at that point. Because the chest wall has had radiation, it is very difficult to expand it. So in those settings where we're doing a delayed post-radiation, post-mastectomy, so after a mastectomy with no reconstruction, radiation completed, we use autologous tissue. So that means a woman has the ability to have the plastic surgeon take tissue from somewhere. So they can take it from their belly, sometimes the buttocks, sometimes the latissimus dorsi muscle, which is the back, and you're bringing in new healthy tissue into that area.
I appreciate you saying this so much because I could just hug you because I know there's a rareness to this disease, and I understand that very much. But due to the rareness, there's not as much conversation. And I know women who are going to hang on every word that you said, and they'll be so grateful to hear this from someone who does know about this disease because that's how much we're having to seek out information. And so mm-hmm. this is going to be extremely helpful. So thank you for taking some time to devote to what hopefully most women will never have to deal with. But for the ones who do, they really, really appreciate your input.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry. I knew you would bring a unique view into that rare type of cancer that so many women are hungry for the information. And thanks, Gemini, for helping us understand some of that. Lisa, you have been very patient, waiting for your turn to ask the doctor a question, and you are up. It's your turn.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gemini. We really appreciate this opportunity. So at FORCE, we see women at all stages of their sort of hereditary breast and ovarian cancer journey. So right after testing, women who have tested a long time, women who are undergoing surveillance or who are choosing to have surgery. And once somebody makes the decision to have a mastectomy, it seems like there's so much emotion attached to that that you make that decision and you feel like you're done. But there's actually subsequent decisions beyond reconstruction that need to be made. So I was hoping we could get your insights on two of those, whether or not to keep your nipple, to have a nipple-sparing mastectomy or not. And this would be both in the cases of a BRCA1, BRCA2 carrier who hasn't had cancer or one that does, and on lymph node biopsies, because I know a lot of women get different perspectives on whether or not they should have a sentinel lymph node biopsy at the time of preventative mastectomy.
Lisa, those are great questions and great things to discuss about like the newer things that we have at our fingertips to be able to offer. So I'll start off with the nipple sparing, and I want to clarify we're going to start off with the patient that does not have cancer who has a BRCA mutation. So when someone has gone through all the decision-making, finally gets there, there's two components of this decision for nipple sparing that are important. The first one is the patient a candidate? Is from a cosmetic perspective, I take a lot of input from our plastic surgeons. We make the decision together and sort of figure out whether the nipple sparing option is a good cosmetic option for that particular person. So breast size, body habitus, all of this. And also making sure that the woman understands that although you're keeping the nipple, there is absolutely no sensation left. So this is just done to avoid nipple reconstruction. So many women have been somewhat dissatisfied with the current techniques available for reconstruction of the nipple with the tattoos and the grafting, and so there's been all of this interest in trying to preserve the nipple. So most of the studies that have been published, there's a problem with them in that we have not been doing this for many, many years. Like in mastectomies, skin sparings have been around for decades. Nipple sparings have been around for a while, but not a lot of data with long-term follow-up. But having said that, the data that is available shows that it seems to be reasonable to do it. So reasonable means there's probably maybe a smaller risk. And so for me, when I'm counseling somebody who has a BRCA mutation, I make sure that they've had an MRI before we talk about surgery, that they've been screened, that there's nothing going on. And then I say, you know, the data seems to appear that this is safe, but we're also hoping that as we go forward, we're also watching the literature and evidence-based studies about what's going on with recurrences. But there doesn't seem to be an increased risk for this approach. So I do offer these types of interventions, and I think that it gives women choices about what they want, and part of being able to go back to quality of life after making a decision with knowing that they were able to keep their nipple and keep most of their breast looking as much as their native breast used to. A little bit different in the cancer setting, and also there is a bunch of studies out, again, not long-term follow-up on these studies, that seem to say reasonable, that it's feasible, and that it is safe. There has to be a very, very important component of patient selection. So I am very, very careful on who I would offer this to, whether they have a BRCA mutation or they don't. So it has to be a very small tumor and pretty far away from the nipple, where I'm not thinking that there's going to be extensive disease anywhere there. We also at Memorial tend to send a separate little margin on the nipple at the end. And if any of this comes back on the final, and I have this discussion with my patients, that if there's any kind of tumor that they see there, then we're going to go back and recommend that that nipple be removed. And so very careful selection, strict criteria of what's feasible, and having a good discussion so people understand what we know as doctors and why there is a little bit more caution in this scenario. Do you have any other questions about that before I move to the sentinel node?
No, that was great. Thank you.
Okay, good. So sentinel node biopsy, the way I do it and most of us at Sloan Kettering do it is we basically get an MRI, and we published a study a couple years ago that looked at saying that even in the highest risk women, if you've had an MRI within 6 months and it didn't show anything in the breast, it's fine to not do the sentinel node biopsy. So I don't routinely do it. If there is any kind of abnormality present in either breast and we're contemplating doing prophylactic surgery, I try to get a biopsy of that so that I know that what I'm going into, so that I'm not surprised and that there is nothing that's found later as a surprise. So the incidence of occult cancers, occult meaning we didn't know that there was a cancer when we went and did the surgery and then found one on the final pathology results, is about 3%. And with MR, with the use of MRI preoperatively, even if there was one that wasn't identified, it's usually really tiny, or ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a type of breast cancer that doesn't go to the nose. So for that reason, again, we avoid the morbidity of doing anything with the lymph nodes unless we have to, because even with a sentinel lymph node biopsy, the possibility of lymphedema, albeit mild, is about 2%.
Excellent. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks for great questions, Lisa. Jennifer, did you have another question?
Really, I think we can go on to Terry. Jennifer has just been called to work.
I'm sorry?
Jennifer has dropped from the show because she was just running. She was called by from work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Terry, I think that we answered most of your questions. Did you have another question for the doctor before we move on to our panel questions?
Well, I do have a comment about the lymphedema, and I think it's wonderful to see that so much is being done to protect women. I think that lymphedema needs to be talked about more because it is a very life-altering condition to live with, and I know for myself I do have lymphedema in my arm on my IBC side. They had to take all my nose. Again, I was a different case. I understand that. And I'm very excited to see the conversation coming up more and more. I attend a lot of research meetings because what we do with the IBC Network is we fund research, and I'm hearing more and more surgeons say, how can we best protect the patient's health but cause as little harm as possible of lymphedema? So I really appreciate just that, just being part of the conversation, because I think that's one of the things I'd like to see kind of grow up in the cancer conversation, is that now that we've spared her life, hopefully, with what we've done, how can we give her the best quality of life by protecting her from lymphedema? So thank
Great.
You for just addressing it.
Thanks.
Excellent point, Terry. Priya, I know we have some questions that our listeners have submitted. Do you want to approach some of those, or would you like me to?
I'll start with the questions, Priya. Thank you so very much. Dr. Jalajani, we've got a list of questions having been sent in by our participants today. I'll just go over them, and we could quickly try to answer that. We have around 15 minutes more. The first one is, what are some of the options for dealing with post-mastectomy and reconstructive scars?
There's not, unfortunately, there's not great options for this. I think the surgical technique is important to minimize the scars as much as possible. So if we do skin sparings, try to keep the scars as small as possible in the scenarios that we're talking about. The reconstructive scars tend to fall within our own surgical scars, so per se they're not different. I think that other points to consider are if someone has implants, for example, and they're going to need some kind of reconstruction, radiation, then it's important to discuss with them that there may be some impact to the implants from the radiation and that there may be additional surgeries necessary to help with the effects of the radiation on the implants. But some plastic surgeons advocate using like silicone sheeting on the scars, and there are over-the-counter types of creams and things that can be used once the initial healing period is done with. I find that sometimes they're helpful and sometimes they're not, and it has a lot to do with how people heal, and not everyone heals the same way. And the one most important thing I would say is that we tend to underestimate or maybe even forget is sun exposure. So keeping, SPF high, especially post-radiation, keeping out of direct sunlight is so huge for healing and darkening of the skin and all of those effects that happen from the treatments that we administer. And we sometimes, something as simple as that, we forget to emphasize to women how particularly important it is to keep that side covered, especially in the first year after treatment, if encompassed of radiation.
Thank you, doctor. The next question is, many breast cancer patients have been through rediagnosis, new tumors, additional surgeries, and even metastatic disease 7 years after first diagnosis, and have been tested and found to lack the BRCA gene. Can you tell us if 5 years is still viewed as a magic number and how the stage of first diagnosis comes into play with a recurrence?
So, I mean, I don't think that there's anything particularly magic about 5 years. And the reason that 5 years comes up is because most of the randomized trials and a lot of the research studies used 5 years for follow-up, which was a significant amount of time. And so we tend to, for example, use these in NCCN and all the databases about cures and staging and all of that. And so there are patients who unfortunately do recur after their first diagnosis, and there are really two different kinds of occurrences that can occur. Those things that occur locally, for example, in the area of the chest wall, the breast, the lymph nodes, or sometimes distant, so in some organ or bone and all of those. And so they do depend on the type of cancer that you were diagnosed with at the first go. The higher the stage, which usually is an indicator of lymph nodes being involved, do make it a slightly higher risk, even though the treatments that we have now are much more effective than they were years ago, and we have a lot more hope and more cures. It is still these 5 year numbers and how their stage plays relates to how you basically found the cancer and where you were when you first walked through the door of your doctor's office.
The next question is, as we learn more about BRCA gene mutation, what can you tell us about the future of research, including BRCA3 and BRCA4 mutations, and how this may change the way we treat breast cancer?
So I think right now we're in a very, very exciting time. There is so much information about genetics and different genes are coming into play. I do not think there will be a, and I could be wrong because there's so much data coming out, a BRCA3 or 4 per se, but I think that there will be a combination of gene alterations that are found that are more significant per se. So as we study genes and we're able to catalog them and associate them with risk, we'll be able to target them better. And so I think that right now we have so much information coming from genetics that it will be an interesting time to follow this. As far as treatment goes, we are able to now tailor whether somebody needs chemotherapy or not. When I first started treating women with breast cancer, we were giving chemotherapy to premenopausal women who had X type of tumors, for example. And now we use Oncotype DX and other tests like that where if someone is estrogen receptor positive and their lymph nodes are negative, we send this gene test of the cancer that I've removed to give me an idea of how aggressive that particular tumor is and not just size, so that someone may be able to avoid chemotherapy by just having to take tamoxifen, for example, if their gene test of their tumor is reasonable score, whereas for the higher risk, we're like, oh, okay, this person really does need chemotherapy because X, Y, and Z. So I think that at least for us and a lot of centers, we've come to the realization that targeting the cancer and the biology of the cancer is just as important as what you do surgically.
The next question is also on BRCA. It is it necessary to offer double mastectomy if BRCA positive, and does this ensure that the breast cancer will not come back?
So when I hear this question, I'm going to answer it as though the patient has breast cancer and has the BRCA gene. So depending on the age that the person was diagnosed and also which mutation it is or alteration, whether it's BRCA1 or BRCA2, doesn't necessarily mean that a double mastectomy is always recommended. And the reason is that the data tells us that for the cancer that someone has, what they came in with, can be treated with lumpectomy and radiation as well as mastectomy. And the risk of reoccurrence for that cancer is the same. The only reason that we tend to go with double mastectomy and tend to say this may be a better option is because you're reducing the risk of getting another cancer. Not so much the one that you're treating, but the possibility that because you have this gene, we'll cure you of this, we'll prevent this, and you end up getting another one. So in someone who's older, who doesn't have the same life expectancy as a 30 or a 40-year-old, then that scenario kind of tips more towards doing less, where someone who's 30, for example, who comes in, who has a breast cancer who's also BRCA, has more options and a better profile doing more risk-reducing surgery for the future.
Our next listener wants to ask, what does it mean to have a high-risk lesion in my breast?
So a high-risk lesion usually pertains to having had a biopsy of some sort, of any sort, and the pathologist found atypical cells, like atypical ductal hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ, which unfortunately has the word carcinoma and is not cancer, but is also one of these high-risk lesions, atypical lobular hyperplasia. Those, all of those are basically lesions that are found in the breast tissue that increase a woman's risk for developing breast cancer in the future. So it doesn't mean that they turn into breast cancer. It just means that they, that person has a marker that has identified that their breast tissue is more at risk for developing a cancer compared to a woman who doesn't have these markers.
We have received a couple of questions on a lumpectomy. First one is, prior to a lumpectomy, what breast imaging is typically performed and what information does this provide?
So I always tailor the testing that I need based on the presentation. And so women's age, how they found the cancer. So if it was found on mammography with calcifications, for me that's all I would need to assess the candidacy for lumpectomy. If someone felt a lump and their breasts are extremely dense and they're very young and the mammogram doesn't aid us, then in those cases I do sometimes recommend an MRI. And if someone is a BRCA carrier and comes in with a cancer, we do recommend an MR for those patients too.
This is the next question, lumpectomy, which is, are there options for the location of the incision for lumpectomy? And can I ask about this to the surgeon?
You know, that's actually a really interesting question because sometimes a surgeon doesn't have a choice where to put an incision because it depends on where the cancer is in the breast. I always try to picture in my mind putting an incision as cosmetic as possible, keeping it away from something that's visible, but also factor in my mind whether if I had to go back to do a mastectomy, I wanted to put my incision someplace where I could possibly incorporate it. I try to go as close to the cancer as possible with the incision because it helps with not having to travel through and create more scar in the breast. And it also helps with the scar and location for radiation and also in cases where you can't feel the tumor, it is a more accurate, many times when someone doesn't feel a tumor, the biopsy that was done to diagnose the cancer was done by a radiologist and they've left a marker there. And that's how I know where to go because we target that marker. And so I factor where I put my incision in relation to the marker and where the cancer is. But many of my patients and I have this discussion. How big is the incision? Where are you going to put it? How's my breast going to look? How much tissue are you going to take out? Will I have a good cosmetic outcome? I think these are all good questions for women to talk to their doctors about.
Another one question, which is, I just want to know, how much time does a skin-sparing mastectomy take? And is this longer than a regular mastectomy?
So I think it's all surgeon-dependent, but it takes us a little bit longer, but not a lot longer. So typically, I would say maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Okay. Yes. So the next question is, what can I do to prepare for a double mastectomy?
I don't think per se, besides the decision-making and kind of having enough support from your family and friends for this kind of decision, there isn't much that you knew that a woman needs to do to get the surgery. I think the usual things, eating well, trying to get some rest, which is usually very difficult, as anxiety tends to take its stronghold right before surgery, but those things are important. And then also discussing with your surgeon and your plastic surgeon about what to expect after in relation to pain and how much activity and preparing for work. I think those are all important components so that there is some type of realistic expectation of what you're going to be like when you get home. I also think that the type of reconstruction that's done also affects the recovery. So having a good understanding of how long that's going to be is so crucial, because some women think they'll be back in their jobs in like a week or two. And honestly, I think that you can probably at that point maybe do some work from home, but depending on what you do for work, that may be a short estimate. So I think the preparation is not only your physical, but also all the things that you need to take care of to get back to your life.
We have just two more questions before we wrap up. Our first one is, a listener wants to know, what is cryoablation?
So cryoablation is this newer technique that basically puts a probe into the breast and freezes the area completely. So it's usually used right now and FDA approved for fibroadenomas, which are benign growths. And it's just one of those newer techniques that is available out there, but not outside of research settings, not in the cancer setting.
The last question, Dr. Jemignani, is what are some of the most important questions to ask your breast surgeon when you're first diagnosed with breast cancer?
I think it's important to bring a friend or bring someone that you trust so that you have a second set of ears to go to the consultation. It goes a long way to helping listen and also to have someone else ask questions if you're feeling overwhelmed at that initial consultation, because it is a little scary when you first walk in and you don't know what the doctor's going to say or any of those. So bringing someone along is important. As far as the kind of questions that you have, just basic questions. So what kind of cancer do I have? How large an area is it? What are my surgical options? Should I have surgery first? Should I have chemotherapy first? Will chemotherapy be part of my treatment? Asking questions like, how do you make as a doctor that determination of whether I need to have radiation or whether I need to have chemotherapy? When does that happen? What's the process in which I will be treated? Those are very important questions. And sometimes it's always good to say, when you're given options, about two different ways, should I conserve the breast? Should I have a mastectomy? I think that it is okay to say, well, what do you think is best for me? Because people are afraid to say, to ask particularly what the doctor is thinking about their recommendations, or they may simply say, I think both options are great and depends on different factors, and they can label them for you. But I think it's okay to certainly ask the expert or the doctor that you're seeing, what do you think is my best treatment option, and how and what other members of my team will I need to have, and how do I set that up? So I think in a comprehensive cancer center, we offer that, for example, at Memorial, where you come in and you meet with us, but there will be other members of the team that you will also meet at different times of your treatment, and I certainly outline for my patients when those consultations will occur.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jemignani. That was an amazing discussion. It was great to have you with us today. I thank all of your panelists too, Beverly, Lisa, Terry, and Jennifer. You were wonderful. The link for today's broadcast I will be shared with all participants. Audience, thank you for your support. And for upcoming shows, please visit curepanel.carefeed.in. You can also always mail me, priya@trialx.com. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Priya.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy being on the show.
Thank